Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Morteza Hajizadeh, the host of the channel, and today we're in the presence of greatness. We have Professor Jim Al-Khalili with us. He's a world-famous theoretical physicist at the University of Surrey in England, and he holds a distinguished chair in physics as well as a university chair in public engagement in science. He's also a prominent author and a broadcaster with BBC. He has written over 14 books on popular science and the history of science, some of which have been translated into 26 languages. And today he's here with us to talk about his latest book, The Joy of Science, published by Princeton University Press. Professor Jim Al-Khalili, welcome to New Books Network.
Hi, Morteza. Glad to be here.
There are lots of things I want to ask, and I hope to be able to get to them all within the short amount of time we have. So to start with, it's customary to ask our guests how they became interested in the area in which they are an expert. So how did you become interested in physics, especially theoretical physics? And maybe you can tell us who is a theoretical physicist and how is it different from an experimental physicist?
Sure. Yes. Well, I mean, I guess I was a teenager when I got interested in physics as a subject. I realized I was good at it. Far better at physics than chemistry and biology, because in chemistry and biology, you had to remember stuff. And I wasn't good at remembering, or I could memorize, but then I'd forget it very quickly. Whereas physics, for me, was about solving puzzles. It was about common sense, logical thinking. If I do this, what happens? It was only when I was at university studying physics that I realized I actually much preferred theoretical over experimental physics. Going into labs and tweaking dials and being not in control, in a sense, because you have instruments and equipment that go wrong. In theoretical physics, it was all about doing maths, doing writing computer codes. It was stuff that I felt I could contain within my head and have some sense of control over. And I've always enjoyed maths, the algebra and the calculus. So I realized very quickly that if I was going to be a professional physicist, I wanted to do theory. The maths, the algebra, the computer programming, rather than going into a lab doing experiments.
Yeah, you just mentioned like it was difficult to retain all that information with biology, maybe because it has something to do with memorization. Mm. And yeah, I studied science when I was in high school and my biology was horrible. It was okay in physics. And once I had this teacher, well, we don't want to badmouth the teacher, but anyway, I failed one quote. But when I redid that physics course, I actually understood rather than trying to memorize things, and everything kind of nicely fell into place.
Yeah. That's always very satisfying, isn't it? When things when the penny drops.
Yeah, it's just like it was like a moment of epiphany. I just discovered something new. So let's talk about your book, The Joy of Science. How did this book come about? Why did you decide to write it? And did the pandemic and all this renewed interest in science and also the people who are kind of anti-science, we saw a wave of them. Did it play any role?
Well, it's certainly a book of our time, and it would be nice to say it was prompted and triggered by the pandemic and by the importance of having to explain how science works for people to gain trust in science, whether it's about having a vaccine, whether it's about other sort of health and behavior issues. But actually, the book was born before the pandemic. My previous book, a book called The World According to Physics, the final chapter was really about how we do science. How have we discovered what we know about the universe? So it gave me an opportunity to talk about what's called the scientific method. And it was that that I felt could be expanded more broadly. So this new book, The Joy of Science, is really about not only celebrating the achievements of science, but also explaining how we do science and the fact that wider society could, in the humblest possible way, I'm suggesting, benefit from some of the rational approaches that we use in the process of science and learning about the world, but use it in daily life.
And in the book, you make this distinction between science and knowledge, which I really loved. And I come from a humanistic background myself, and I know you are also a humanist. Let's get started with some definitions, and then I'll ask you the other question, which is about this dichotomy that is between science and humanities, which is a big thing, especially in the United States with culture wars. But anyway, how do you distinguish between science and knowledge? Because to a lot of people, science is facts, but your definition is different.
Yeah, exactly. So people think if someone is good at science, it means they know stuff. They know, you know, the bones in the body or the chemical symbols or the equations of Newton's laws of motion or whatever. That's not, those are facts. And facts are part of the body of knowledge that we have about the world. Science is a way of gaining that knowledge. Of course, there are other ways, you know, through reading books, through art and culture and literature and poetry and debate and discussion, listening to someone who knows more than you, life experience. But if we want to find out how the world works, what a reality is, then science is, in my view, the best way. So science is not the facts, it's not the knowledge, it's the process by which we gain that knowledge. And it's that process that is what we call science or the scientific method.
And speaking of that process, and that's what I'm kind of interested in, scientific method. Many people just assume that science is just walking into a lab, but just as you mentioned, there is a process, a scientific method, which has criteria such as falsibility, replicability, and you do mention some of them in the book. So can you define scientific method? And there is this very famous scientific method, Popper approach, which I listened to one of your interviews, and he said it's kind of declining and people are becoming more, or scientific community is becoming more in favor of a Bayesian approach. So can you tell us what scientific method is?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of people who work in this area, philosophers of science, for example, would say if there isn't the scientific method, there are scientific methods because science is so broad. So people do think the scientist is usually male, right, and usually white, and wearing a white lab coat and going into a lab and messing around with test tubes or maybe writing very difficult algebra on a blackboard. Science is broad. So science can be, you know, sitting on a cliff edge observing nesting behavior of birds. It could be climbing into a volcano. It could be developing computer models to study the climate. You know, it could be mixing chemicals in a lab. So there are lots of ways that or criteria that we call are part of the umbrella of the scientific method. Certainly, yeah, people say, well, scientific method is about being curious about the world, but lots of people are curious about the world. Even a conspiracy theorist would argue they're being curious and they're searching for answers. Or you say science is about coming up with a hypothesis and then looking for evidence to support or refute that. Well, a historian does the same thing. So here you talk about the two cultures. There are lots of similarities. You know, history isn't part of science, but history and science both use the same approach of coming up with a narrative, a story, and then testing it. Popper was a famous philosopher of science in the 20th century. He talked about scientific theory needs to be refutable. So it needs to be, you know, we need to be able to knock it down to say that it's false. That, as you mentioned, is slightly falling out of favor now, although, you know, a lot of scientists still think it's very important. So the nice example is you say all swans are white. You only need one brown swan to refute that theory. But of course, that brown swan may just be a white swan caked in mud. So the refutation, how do we know that's the true thing? Why do we refute something or trust something that goes against a theory and get rid of the theory? You know, you have to weigh things up. And that's where this Bayesian approach, Bayesian inference comes in. It seems to be a very sensible way. It's an area, a method in statistics. Basically, it says, you know, you have a hypothesis, you have a theory. You start off with what are called priors, assumptions or things that you can say about it that you start off with. But then you gather evidence and data and you can revise those priors. So it's a way of working out the probability that something is right. It's used in lots of areas of science now, and lots of people even think of it as a philosophy of life. You know, people talk about me, I'm a Bayesian naturalist. You know, I don't believe something. I say, well, what are the chances that this is right? What do I know? What can I infer from that? So that seems to be a more sensible approach.
And I'm going to go back to the distinction made between knowledge and science. And we might pick it up later on as we speak about other topics in the book. To me, when I read, when we come up with this distinction between science and knowledge, there might be this misconception that science is always prioritized over knowledge. There is this hierarchy, and whatever it is proven through a scientific method is valid knowledge. But whatever, for example, a historian comes up with, a sociologist comes up with, a philosopher comes up with, is not proper knowledge. It's just a set of assumptions, opinions. And in humanities, we have this problem. There is no scientific method in humanities, and there can't be because the nature of the knowledge is different. So, and I'm asking this because I know you are also a humanist. Do you think that a humanist approach to some of the problems of the world we're dealing with is less of a value than a scientific method? Or let me put it this, is science the panacea to the problems we have in the world?
Of course not. As I said, there are lots of different ways of gaining knowledge, and the scientific method is one. The scientific method, it's much easier to sort of argue and shout about how great the scientific method is when we're talking about how it applies to the natural sciences, physics, chemistry, biology, astronomy, geology. You know, there's stuff out there. There's facts about the world. There's, you know, the Darwinian theory of natural selection, the germ theory of disease, plate tectonics, the model of our solar system with the Earth going around the sun and not the other way around. This is stuff as, you know, although we say there are, you know, no facts and scientists should never be 100% certain, as good as damn it, we know these to be true. And no amount of debate or discussion or contemplation in philosophy or any other area of human thinking is going to change those facts that were discovered by the scientific process. So in some areas, what we've learned about the world through science is, a sense, non-negotiable. But it doesn't, of course, apply to the complexity of human behavior and human nature and morality and ethics and so on. There are areas where science really is very limited in what it can say, which is why the world would be a very boring place if we were all just adopting the scientific method to find out how to live our lives. There are our lives and the human condition is far more complex than that.
Yeah, and I guess scientists from early days had always these grand ideas of creating a utopia. Forgot the name of the, it's on tip of my tongue, but it just skips my mind. The famous British, the father of science in England, wrote also a novel, back in the during Enlightenment. I'm sure you remember.
I think Bacon or...
Francis Bacon.
Francis Bacon. Okay.
That's right.
Right.
let me ask you about a quote from your book. I'd like to read this quote from the book. The fate of humanity lies not so much in the hands of politicians, economists, or religious leaders, but in the knowledge that we gain about the world through science. Which this is something hardly anybody could disagree with, because especially in the past 2 years and the pandemic, the scientists created the vaccine, saved hundreds of thousands of lives, but scientific advice is sometimes dismissed by politicians, by economists, Well, I guess the famous example is climate change. Even especially in the United States or even in England, some more conservative politicians simply dismiss scientific advice. And unfortunately, I felt it did some damage to the community. I mean, community, the scientific community. What do you think about this? Do you think that is it in the hands of scientists or politicians?
Well, I mean, first of all, we should say, and I think scientists are starting to thankfully recognize this, that even though we can provide evidence and advice to governments, to policymakers, scientists aren't elected. It's the politicians who are elected, and it's the politicians who are answerable to the public. And also acknowledging that politicians do, of course, have other things that they have to take into account. Rather than, you know, if we offer scientific advice on a particular policy, politicians also have to take into account economics, public acceptability, and, you know, and other aspects. So it may be that, well, yes, the scientific advice is to do this, but on balance, we should do something else. We saw this in during the pandemic. You know, balancing lockdown versus having the economy suffering in the long term, sort of thing. But certainly, the challenges that face us in the 21st century, the United Nations, there's a whole list of goals that it says, you know, we have to strive for to achieve, whether it's, you know, tackling climate change, biodiversity, poverty, disease, all those sorts of things. They're not going to be solved by sitting around debating, discussing. They're not going to be solved by economics. They are going to need, first and foremost, a scientific solution. Climate change is the best example. You know, we do need to have the scientists offering advice, and we hope to convince politicians that they need to think on an evidence-based way of developing their policies. We've seen it during the pandemic, and I hope that politicians have sort of learnt from that how important it is to listen to the scientists.
Let us talk about the book, and you do mention this fact in the book as well. Science can offer advice and solutions, but again, the politicians have to take into account the impacts of their decisions on the community. Yeah. The joy of science. I remember when I majored in English, and when people asked me why I majored in English, I said that because I love poetry, I love arts, but because science is, and I studied science in my country. You had to choose a major in your high school, and I studied science in high school. And the rationale that I had for choosing English in university was that science is a very hardcore set of dry facts, but you don't agree with this. And the name of the book is The Joy of Science. And to be perfectly honest with you, when I started reading the book, I wanted to read the book with a critical mind, but then after the first chapter, I started smiling and I just went through the whole book and absolutely loved it. And you start with, again, some examples in the book as well. So how could science be joyful? Doesn't it kill the beauty of, for example, the rainbow, the example you use in the book, to explain it scientifically?
Yes, well, this is certainly what the poet Keats accused Isaac Newton of when, you know, Newton, having discovered that sunlight can be broken up into the different colors, you know, using a prism, he said, "You've destroyed the magic of the rainbow by breaking it up into its prismatic colors." And my point, and I'm not the first person, obviously, to argue this, you know, very many other great scientists, you know, people like Richard Feynman, Carl Sagan, even Richard Dawkins, that knowing something more about how the world works doesn't destroy the magic. It doesn't turn it into hard, cold, rational, you know, Mr. Spock type worldview. It adds to the beauty. A scientific explanation of something can be as spiritual, as uplifting, as joyous as the most beautiful poem or the most beautiful painting or piece of music. Certainly some areas of science you need the expertise to appreciate it, but in the same way that, you know, you need some understanding of modern art to appreciate a piece of abstract art or complex piece of music. The rainbow is a good example. We say the rainbow is beautiful and it has colors, but you scientists come along and talk about, you know, light being reflected and refracted, the angles and so on, and trigonometry. Actually, learning about the rainbow, as I describe in the book, adds to the beauty. We learn, for example, through science, that no two people see the same rainbow. each one of us sees our own unique rainbow because it's particular droplets of water suspended in the air from rain that reflect a colored light into our eyes at a specific angle. They don't reflect that light into another person's eye standing next to us. So we each see our own individual rainbow. Rainbows are actually full circles, not just arcs. And you can see that if you're up in the sky, or like pilots and planes see that. So learning more about how the world is makes it more wondrous, makes it more joyful, and you know, wanting to celebrate it. It doesn't wrap it up into these logical hard facts. And if people think of science as just logic and hard facts, then the people teaching them aren't doing a good job.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And the example of John Keats that you mentioned reminded me of the American poet Walt Whitman, who had this famous poem, The Learned Astronomer.
Oh, yes. Depressing. I sometimes get that attitude at parties as well, that, you know, I get accused of, oh, Jim, you're just depressingly logical.
Yeah. And so I appreciate that as a piece of poetry, but I guess especially in 21st century, that's not a good stand for humanists to bring up, that scientists kill the joy of, you know, the beauty of the world or anything. Anyway, let's move on. You are a world famous physicist and quantum physics, and you've more recently been talking in lectures about quantum biology, which is even more fascinating. And one of the lessons in your book, I should have mentioned it maybe in the beginning of the talk, there are 8 chapters, there are 8 lessons, the joy of science. One of them is it's more complicated than that. So I'm going to defer to that. I know quantum biology is difficult to explain, but
okay,
what is it? And maybe you could give us an example of how it can help us to better understand maybe the secrets of world or life.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, certainly, I think, I make that point that sometimes, you know, we do like, especially in today's world, to simplify things. Don't blind me with details, you know, just give me the bottom line, the tweet, the meme. And sometimes issues and topics are more complicated. And in science as well, you know, we can't always, even for me as a science communicator, I try and get across complex ideas as simply as possible. But sometimes, you know, the subtleties, the details are buried deeper, and one has to work harder to explain and the other person to understand. Quantum biology, no, I can have a stab at explaining it briefly. We know there's quantum physics and there's quantum chemistry. When I say we, you know, sort of the scientific community. Quantum mechanics, the theory of atoms and molecules and subatomic particles, and it's a very strange scientific understanding of reality from the one of our everyday experience of, you know, balls bouncing and pendulums swinging and things rolling, the stuff, the physics that we learn at school. Quantum mechanics says that down at the atomic scale, atoms and subatomic particles behave in a very probabilistic, fuzzy way that's very hard to grasp, almost magical and counterintuitive. In physics and chemistry, we're used to this. In biology, biologists have really not needed to think about quantum mechanics, even though the processes of life, if you zoom in deep enough, they're down to the behavior of molecules. So quantum biology doesn't mean that all life is ultimately made of atoms, and atoms need quantum mechanics to describe them, therefore life does, because, you know, everything is made of atoms, right? And quantum biology isn't also this, ooh, quantum mechanics is very strange and weird and trippy, and therefore it will explain mysteries like the nature of consciousness, or it might explain mysteries like, you know, alternative medicines. No, quantum biology is simply a new field that we're discovering that inside living cells there are certain processes that only work because of the magic of quantum mechanics that seem to be very vital for life. An example that I'm working on with my research group at Surrey, in fact, we've just published a paper in the journal Nature on how DNA, the double helix of life, undergoes mutations because of an individual atom jumping from one strand of DNA to the other. And that atom is atom of hydrogen, which provides the glue that holds the strands together. it's been suggested, even Crick and Watson, who worked on the double helix back in the early 50s, had suggested this in a paper, that you could get mutations due to this hydrogen atom jumping across. No one had done the calculation carefully enough. We've just written a paper showing that actually it's looks like it's much more important than people thought. There's lots more I could talk about, but that's probably enough detail to whet your appetite.
Yeah, it certainly is. And there is another thing in physics. Well, actually, I have this nerdy friend, Kevin, who wanted me to ask this question, wave pilot theory, which is, again, and the way he told me that there are few physicists who are proponent of this theory, and you're one of them. Is that also simple enough to explain?
Probably. Okay. Normally, it's called pilot wave theory, not wave pilot theory. That's all right. So quantum mechanics is probably the only theory in science that seems to have multiple narratives, multiple interpretations of explaining what the maths means. Now, normally, you know, in a theory, you have the algebra, and then you say, what do these symbols stand for? How does this connect to the real world? Einstein's theory of relativity, Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, Newton's law of gravity, all those things you can equate the maths to reality via some sort of narrative. Quantum mechanics has these multiple ways of explaining it, and each of them makes the same, each of them agrees with the maths, each of them agrees with every experiment we care to test. So we're unable to work out which is correct. So one of the most popular ones is called the many worlds theory, which says that there are multiple parallel universes, parallel realities. The pilot wave theory was proposed first by a French physicist called Louis de Broglie in the 1920s, and then developed further by an American physicist, David Bohm. Yes, you're right. It's one that's sort of less popular than others. I'm not sure I'm a proponent of it strictly, but I'm a fan in the sense that I sort of quite like it, would like it to be the correct interpretation. What I do believe is there is a correct interpretation out there. It's just that we haven't found which one it is. Nature behaves in a certain way. The fact that we have got lots of ways of explaining, that's our problem, not nature's. And we need to find out which is the correct one. Pilot wave theory simply says there's one universe, particles, that we talk about particles behaving also like waves. It says there are waves and particles, and it's the waves that carry the particles. And so it almost splits reality into these two different concepts. Lots of physicists don't like it. It has its own difficulties and problems, but every interpretation of quantum mechanics has something that we can criticize about it. Otherwise, we would have found the right one by now. We're still looking.
and it's, again, I listened to one of your talks here. Is it what that wave you talked about, that's what called phantom, if I'm not mistaken?
When I tend to, in popular accounts, when I talk about quantum tunneling, the particle that behaves like a wave that can actually get through what should be an impenetrable energy barrier, I say it's like a phantom passing through, like a ghost passing through a brick wall. We don't see that happening in our everyday world. Yet down at the atomic scale, quantum tunneling is something that happens all the time. It's just, that's just the way nature is in at that scale.
In chapter 2 of your book, you talk about this phenomenon called Occam's razor phenomenon.
Occam's razor, yes.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting, there are many interesting examples from science and anecdotes you use in the book. And then you talk about Einstein's biggest blunder. So I was wondering, for the benefit of the audience, you could talk about that. What is Occam's razor phenomenon?
So William of Ockham was a medieval monk in England. In fact, he lived in a village not far from my university. Occam's razor is this principle we tend to use, not just in science, but in everyday life, which is that the simplest solution or the simplest answer is probably the right one. You know, why complicate things more than you need to? And it's very powerful. But sometimes, particularly in science, the simplest answer isn't the correct one. Sometimes it is a bit more complicated than that. So, you know, Einstein, when he was developing his theory of gravity, which went, you know, we've now called general relativity, went beyond Newton's picture of gravity. He was trying to describe the whole universe. And he said, well, the universe is full of stuff, right? Full of matter. And matter pulls itself together. So why isn't the universe just imploding due to the mutual attraction of gravity? There must be something holding it stable. And he called that thing the cosmological constant. It was a Greek letter in his equation for the describing the universe. But then we discovered the universe is actually expanding. So for Einstein, it was like the universe was like a ball halfway up a hill, and gravity should pull the ball back down. So his cosmological constant sort of held the ball in place, kept it stable. When we discovered the universe is actually expanding since the Big Bang, that's like the ball has been kicked up the hill. So it's going up the hill, but gravity is constantly slowing it down. And we thought, well, one day it'll either, you know, get to the top of the hill or it'll roll back down again. And that's what we call the Big Crunch. So Einstein suddenly realizes, okay, I don't need my cosmological constant. I don't need anything to hold the thing in place because it's been set in motion up the hill in the first place. He called it his biggest blunder. Fast forward to 1998, and astronomers discover the universe is expanding ever more quickly. So it's like the ball rolling up the hill is rolling up faster and faster. It's crazy. There must be something pushing it up faster and faster. Enter cosmological constant again. That's exactly what you need to make the ball go up again. So as we learn more in science, sometimes the simple solutions aren't the correct ones. Sometimes there's more complexity. In physics, thankfully, things tend to be easy. But a subject like biochemistry, there's layer upon layer of complexity. You learn something and it's all you're doing is peeling back another layer of the onion. And there's another mechanism that causes that to happen. So yeah, Occam's razor isn't always right. We'd like it to be. And in everyday life, it's the same. There are issues in everyday life, whether to do with ideology or politics or whatever, where we like to think that the correct answer is the simple one. But we should learn from science that sometimes you just need to think about things a bit more deeply.
Mm-hmm. And let us talk about another part of your book. You do mention that, well, we through a scientific method, we get to truth or reality or fact or whatever term we want to use. But you do also mention that science is not free, is not free from bias or ideology. How is that? Because it might come as a surprise to a lot of people. How is it that scientists can bring in his own ideology or biases into the...
You know, scientists are humans and scientists are fallible like everyone else. We try and have integrity and honesty. But of course, you know, a scientist wants their experiment to be correct. They want their result or their theory to be right. They want to publish papers. They want to get research grants. They want to get promotion. They want the respectability of their peers and colleagues, just like anybody else. And so, of course, we have our own built-in biases. Sometimes scientists are in the pay of someone. We're not all independent-minded, free-thinking. Sometimes, you know, you have someone telling you what to do, what to research, and someone who has a vested interest in something. And so there are biases in science. What comes to the rescue is the scientific method. The fact that if you come up with an idea, if you're wrong, the truth will out at some point. Others will have to repeat your results, your experiment or your observation, and check if you're right or not. This is the refutability business and repeatability of the scientific method. So the scientific method acts to correct for our natural biases in science. And we'd like to think that in science, we want to test our own ideas. We want to check if we're right or not. We don't just say, right, I believe this is right, and I'm not going to argue with anyone. I want to check, because if I'm wrong, I'd rather find out for myself than have somebody else tell me your theory, your idea isn't worth anything. So while there are biases, we are aware of them. And I think it's more in the social sciences, they're much better at this because there are so many more potential biases and pitfalls when you're dealing with the complexity of human affairs. In the physical sciences, they're less aware of them because we like to think there's an absolute truth out there that we're striving towards and we're all heading in the same direction. But we should also, in all areas of science, be aware of our personal biases and fight against them.
And is that the reason why in the book you do call for more diversity in science? Because, again, a lot of people, even some of your colleagues might say science is science. So if diversity doesn't mean a thing in science, but you do call for more diversity in science.
Absolutely.
Doesn't it detract from objectivity?
Yeah, no. So this is exactly the point about science being the process, not the facts. The facts, the body of knowledge about the world transcends culture and time and space. And if there's an alien civilization on the other side of the galaxy who are smart, they will also have come across quantum mechanics and discovered general relativity and so on. Because the knowledge about the world is what it is. We can't have our own version of the truth, our own version of reality. But the scientific method itself, because we have biases and preconceived notions and preferences and ideological views, in order for that to minimize the bias, we do need people carrying out the process of science who come from different directions. So we need more women in engineering. We need people from other minorities in working in Western universities. We do need people who look at the world in a different way to provide a fresh perspective. Because there are, you know, if everybody only looks tackles a problem from one direction, we're very likely to miss things. But then hopefully the knowledge we gain, if it's correct description of reality, then that is the same. So that is universal. But the scientific process absolutely requires as much diversity and inclusivity as possible.
And you also talk about conspiracy theories and anti-vaxxers, and it's something that has come more to the public's attention in the past 2 years. And you also mentioned that it's not a new phenomenon with the invention of vaccine back in the 18th century. Electricity, we always had people who were against these things. But how do you describe this phenomenon of anti-vaxxers? Some of them are highly educated people. Like my grandmother is illiterate and she took the vaccine. She trusted scientists. Mm. But still, it's quite amazing that in 21st century, we have these anti-vaxxers and they have their own rationales. They don't know their biases. And that's one of the lessons you put in the book, one of the chapters, know your biases.
Yes, it is. It is sad. I mean, you know, if there's a conspiracy theorist who believes the Earth is flat or that we never went to the moon, you know, that's fine. It's harmless. I would find it amusing. You know, but you don't want to belittle people or say, look, you're stupid or you don't know what you're talking about. They feel the same thing about you. So you can't win people over like that. But when it does come something to like, you know, being anti-vaccination, that's dangerous. And you're right. It's not people who are uneducated or not intelligent. But what we need for them to do is absolutely to examine their biases, examine why they believe what they believe, what is the evidence that they've got to go by, what is it that they don't like about the scientific advice that they're being given about a vaccine. Is it because they're being given advice by a government that has also given them poor advice and therefore they're not trusting of anything that body says? If they have built-in prejudices against someone, then whatever that person tells them, they're not going to believe. We do have to enter in that dialogue about checking why we believe what we believe and asking other people to test and to examine their own beliefs. That's the only way we can reach a rational way forward.
And some of these anti-vaxxers, in their own way, do their own research. They come up with evidence, whatever it is. And that brings me to my next question. We live in the 21st century. We have the internet. There's this explosion of information everywhere. And whatever you want to find, whether it's something for the vaccine or against vaccine, you can find it on the internet. But it, as you said, science is a process, so that process could help us to be able to sift through good or bad information. But do you think with the rise of this information culture or this information industry, let's say, scientific expertise or expertise in general is in danger? Does it jeopardize?
Yes, it is a worry because most people, even, you know, however well-meaning they are or smart they are or willing they are to sort of explore, it's hard to know what evidence to trust, who is speaking as an expert who knows what they're talking about and who doesn't, or has maybe a vested interest to promote a particular ideological viewpoint. So it is hard, given the information overload that we're bombarded with. There's information, there's misinformation, there's disinformation deliberately trying to deceive us. And I think it's not, you know, people, you can't tell people, look, open your eyes and see the truth, because as far as they're concerned, they are. They have found the truth because they've gone to some particular website. Is that we all need to understand where those opinions are coming from. And it's hard because we don't all have the time and ability and motivation to explore every piece of information we get on the internet, to dig down and look for its source and then say, is that source reliable and can we trust it? I think we're going to need the help of technology, and that comes with its own dangers. You know, it's good that you have spam filters on your email to stop you getting emails from Nigerians who want to send you millions of dollars or adverts for Viagra or whatever. And it's quite neat that, you know, Alexa knows what music you like to listen to, or Netflix knows the next series that you might like because of reviews. But we need AI to also be able to sift through good information from bad information, from fake news. But who develops that AI? See, this is the problem. You know, you see what's happening, for example, in Russia at the moment, where you have the state-sanctioned information and that's being fed to people. So, yeah, we need the help of AI, but we also don't want it in the hands of unsavory governments, or even in the hands of very powerful organizations like Google and Facebook. We can't do it our own. Technology has given us all the information. We need technology to help us sift through the information as well.
Just on that, do you think the scientific community or scientists, you are also a science promoter, you're a communicator of science. There are some other famous people, both in England and also in America, doing the same job. But do you think scientific community in general is doing enough to bring that science more into the public attention, to become sort of an activist, let's say? And I know that you, for example, you don't get into Twitter debates with anyone, and I think it's the right thing. But do you think the scientific community is doing enough to fight this propaganda, maybe, or to bring those scientific ideas into the public arena more?
I think it's happening a lot more now. I think, you know, certainly since the pandemic, but there has been an acknowledgement among scientists that communicating what we do to the wider public is increasingly important. When I first started as a science communicator, you know, 25 years ago, or more than that maybe, it was not seen as something respectable. You know, I was a young academic doing my own research and publishing papers, and I was warned off by senior colleagues, don't go and talk to, you know, school kids or journalists or write popular articles. You know, focus on your research, leave that to others, right? And I think nowadays, particularly a younger generation of scientists acknowledge that communicating science, engaging with the public on scientific issues, is hugely important and one of our duties as scientists. So we are doing a lot more. There are many more people who are vocal explaining how science works and why we should trust science, not just saying isn't a black hole cool, or isn't the Higgs boson discovery exciting. You know, we're talking about how and why we do science. And also persuading politicians to listen to the science as well. It's becoming ever more urgent with all the different challenges facing us. But I believe certainly in the UK, maybe not everywhere in the world, but certainly UK, I think we are moving in the right direction.
We have very little time, so I'm quickly going to ask you two more questions maybe.
Okay.
One of them is my favorite question, which is the conflict between science and religion. More recently, with a lot of academic research, this myth has been debunked that science and religion have always been in conflict. It started in the 19th century, but in general, I know a lot of some religious, really devout religious scientists and physicists. I guess, if I'm not mistaken, one of them is Tom McLean, if I'm not mistaken.
McLeish,
yes, yeah. Tom McLeish.
Yes, a good friend. Yeah.
Physicist. Yeah, and he also wrote a book, I think it was called Faith and Science. Do you think science and religion have to be in conflict or are in conflict? Because this is something which was again renewed. The discussion was renewed in the past 2 years.
by and large, no, I don't think they need to be in comedy. So people like Tom McLeish, who's a fellow of the Royal Society, is an excellent scientist and a hugely smart guy. He's a very good example. You know, you don't go to him and say, "Oh, you believe in God? You're so stupid. You know, how can you believe in something so irrational as a divine creator?" As you mentioned, I'm a humanist, so I'm not religious, but I acknowledge that firstly, faith is very important to many people for whatever reason that gives them comfort or whatever. You know, it's not something one should belittle. Secondly, I don't think science and religion normally come into conflict. You know, if you're an engineer or a laser physicist or a particle physicist or a geologist, you know, you're doing science. You may have your own personal belief, your faith, and even though I don't believe in it, I don't see how that would make you a worse scientist. There are areas where probably they do butt up against each other, and sort of cosmology and the Big Bang and so on. But even there, I don't think you can, you know, religion would have to change as it has done over the centuries as we discover more about the world. You know, the Earth goes around the sun, not the other way around. Galileo had a hard time, you know, trying to persuade the church of that. But the church survived and had to acknowledge that our scientific way of viewing the world is something that we can test and find reliable. So I don't think there's a conflict, and I don't stand up and argue against people for whom their religious faith is important, even if I wouldn't agree with them on the fundamental basis.
Professor Jima Khalili, just wish we had more time to talk to you. Thank you very much for your generosity and time.
It's my pleasure. It's been fun.
Thank you.